This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates that relate to the natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Eric Mulvar. He's Executive Director of Western Watersheds Project, a nonprofit conservation group that's dedicated to protecting and restoring wildlife and watersheds all through the American West. Eric's a wildlife biologist with scientific research in behavioral ecology and systems ecology of moose. He spent 10 years as an author of guidebooks to national parks and wilderness areas. One is about Wyoming's Red Desert. He's been a conservation professional for 21 years, working first in BLM wilderness inventory and later on oil and gas issues, sage grouse conservation, large carnivore events, land use planning, and livestock issues. So he has a broad background. So welcome, Eric. It's good to be talking to you once again.
Well, thanks for having me back on your show, Jay.
Well, we talked over a year ago, and I'm wondering what the primary projects are that Western Watersheds has been working on.
Well, certainly we've been trying to reform livestock grazing abuses all across Western public lands.
Uh-huh.
And that is a really ongoing project and an ongoing effort. But we've also played a leading role in trying to get wolves relisted in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming through following up with a lawsuit on our petition to list the species again in those three states. In addition, we've been defending grizzly bears throughout the Northern Rockies. We've been trying to foster the recovery of prairie dogs and just won a lawsuit on the Thunder Basin National Grassland in northeastern Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
And have been active in a variety of other issues, including trying to restore beavers to areas where they've been lost throughout the
country. That's great. So, since we last talked, like about a week ago, the election has occurred, and I'm just wondering if it's revised your priorities in any way. Has it started some discussion about what you're focusing on?
Well, of course, we are gearing up to play defense, and you know, we've been here before. We've already had one Trump administration, and during that first 4 years of a Trump presidency, Western Watersheds Project played one of the leading roles in defending against the rollbacks of environmental protections and wildlife protections throughout the West. We were able to successfully sue and win and relist wolves when the Trump administration delisted them. We were able to join the lawsuit that got Bears Ears eventually restored to its former boundaries, and we probably will have to do that again. We were able to get grizzly bears put back on the list through court action. So all of these experiences are examples of battles that we expect to probably have to fight all over again in Trump 2. And we expect a full court press from the new administration to try and dismantle environmental regulations and throw open the public lands to exploitation from commercial industries.
Do you feel you're in a stronger position to litigate than you were last time?
Well, certainly in 2016, Western Watersheds Project had, I believe, 9 employees, and today we have 17. So
almost
twice the staff. We have twice the number of attorneys on staff. We've got, of course, the experience from having to handle the Trump administration and its shenanigans during the first go-round. So I think we're prepared and gearing up to get ready to go and play defense.
There's going to be a dramatic change in the leadership of the departments of government, like Interior, which houses Bureau of Land Management, the national parks and the refuges, and in the Department of Agriculture that houses the Forest Service. So how do you think that those changes in leadership are going to affect your work?
it'll be interesting to see if the Trump administration puts into place the same kind of extremists like William Perry Penley and Karen Bud Fallon into political appointee positions of power and influence. If they do, there's going to be a lot of overreach. And when there's overreach, laws are violated, regulations are violated, and environmental groups like Western Watersheds Project can take the agencies to court and reverse their decisions. That's what we're going to be looking toward, I think. There's also possible that the Trump administration or President Trump will have learned his lesson and will appoint people who are much more cautious and strategic in the way they approach things. So we have to guard against that possibility as well.
The election map showed quite a shift in the districts that voted for Trump, as well as for the House and the Senate in the West. So rural America was solidly behind Trump in spite of his lies and misbehavior and his convictions. And rural America opposes some of the policies that you work on. What do you think motivated rural America this time, the farmers and ranchers and other rural folk, to create such a red map?
Well, I think, you know, the rural areas of the Intermountain West have always leaned very heavily Republican, although there are a number of real environmentalists who live in some of these red states and have been fighting very hard for the wildlife and public lands in those states as well. We intend to represent the will of all Americans because our public lands are supposed to be managed in trust for the benefit of every American, regardless if they're a local from Ennis, Montana, or they're from New York City or Florida or California or Texas. Each of these American citizens would have an equal stake in our public lands and in our wildlife, and we represent that public stake that all Americans have. And it's important to note that regardless of what the electoral map looked like in November, a majority of Americans consistently support public lands, healthy wildlife populations.
Do you have any thoughts or any ideas about how rural America can be turned a little more blue?
Well, you know, Western Watersheds Project is a 501c3, so we're not in the business of trying to shift political leanings.
Yeah.
But certainly we are in the business of educating the public, both the rural voters and the urban voters, on issues that involve our public lands, on issues that involve what constitutes ecological health, and on the threats that face those public lands. So, for instance, many people in the rural West hunt and fish, but they don't really understand that the heavy livestock grazing that's getting authorized on national forests and on Bureau of Land Management lands is directly taking away the forage that would otherwise allow elk and mule deer populations to more than double, that would allow trout streams to recover to healthy levels and maybe have five times the number of fish and maybe have far larger trout. And these are the kinds of information that people are not only unaware of, but often the livestock industry and even federal agencies are actively trying to fool them into thinking that livestock are harmless, that oil and gas drilling is benign, and nothing could be further from the truth.
You wrote an article some time ago that was entitled Cows, Carbon, and Climate Change. What was the thesis of that argument?
Well, part of the argument is that cattle are ruminants, which means they have a four-chambered stomach, and the first chamber is basically a fermentation vat that's run by fungi and bacteria, and the grass goes in and it ferments, and one of the byproducts is swamp gas, methane, that the cattle belch out. And methane is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas, between 25 and 85 times the potency of carbon dioxide in terms of its global warming effects. Now, that's what most people focus on when they think about the impacts of livestock on climate change. But to me, the much bigger impact is the impact of heavy overgrazing in places like the arid West, where the cattle are actively destroying the long-lived perennial bunch grasses that are the basis of Western public land ecosystems. And when they destroy these long-lived, deep-rooted ecosystems and take away that carbon bank that's built up in the soil, they're replacing it with an invasive weed called cheatgrass, which is an annual weed, which means it sprouts from a seed, grows, sets seed, and dies all in a period of about six weeks or so. And then once it dies, it burns. So it's giving up all of its carbon to the atmosphere. So you're taking the arid West and these deserts and shrub steppes and grasslands and turning them from a major carbon bank to a major carbon source. And that's a huge climate impact.
So are there other livestock that also generate methane gas or other pollutants?
In addition to cattle, the other ruminants are sheep and goats.
And pigs.
And pigs are not ruminants, actually.
Okay. But they create a lot of waste. But hey, what about sheep and other animals?
Well, certainly the domestic sheep, the biggest problem with domestic sheep and their grazing on public lands is that domestic sheep carry two diseases that are deadly to wild bighorn sheep. Mm. Those diseases are Mannheimia hemolytica and Mycoplasma ovipositiva. And once those diseases get transmitted, all it takes is a single nose-to-nose contact between one domestic sheep and one bighorn.
Right.
The bighorn will go back to its herd and will transmit that disease, and it will spread like wildfire, and it basically wipes out that population's ability to have any survival for the lambs that are bought, that are brought into the world after that point, and it wipes out the herds. And it's such a virulent series of diseases that once game and fish departments understand that there's been a contact between domestic sheep and bighorn sheep, they have a tendency to go out and actively shoot out all of the bighorns to prevent the disease from spreading. Mm. That's how big a problem it is. So it's essential to keep at least 15 miles of distance from the nearest domestic sheep flock and the nearest domestic or wild bighorn sheep herd. And right now, federal land management agencies aren't requiring that. And that's a major problem for the recovery of bighorn sheep.
So is the implication of your policy that there should be less livestock presence on Western landscapes?
We absolutely need a lot less cattle and a lot less sheep on each and every grazing allotment that the federal government leases out, if they are going to lease federal lands out for livestock grazing at all. And fundamentally, when you look across the West, the average grazing allotment offers 50 to 65% forage utilization to the rancher that leases the land. That means they get to take off 50 to 65% of all the grass that grows between January 1st of the year and December 31st. That leaves only 35 to 50% of the remaining grass for not just the elk and the mule deer, but for the jackrabbits, for the mice, for the grasshoppers, and for the grasses themselves to survive and reproduce. And this is causing desertification across the more arid parts of the West. It's causing a depopulation of native wildlife species. And then, in addition, if the grass utilization and the chronic overgrazing is not bad enough, the ranchers are often permitted to go off and kill all kinds of native carnivores that they see as a threat to their livestock operations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, if you're going to put your private livestock on public lands, then you are taking your own business risk, and you should accept the cost of any losses to wolves, to grizzly bears, to coyotes, as just the cost of doing business.
That's a good point. So BLM land is your primary concern. Is there grazing also in the national forests?
We're also very heavily focused on national forest grazing as well. And there are more than 70 million acres of national forest lands that are leased for livestock grazing. And there on national forest lands, the cattle often are permitted to go even up into alpine meadows, and sheep as well, even inside wilderness that's been designated for protection in some cases. And they're ruining the trout streams, they're wiping out the forage base for the native herbivores, and they're also threatening the populations of native carnivores as well.
Is there grazing in wildlife refuges as well?
We do see some national wildlife refuges that authorize livestock grazing inside the refuges. And the law states that a refuge only is allowed to have livestock grazing if that livestock grazing advances the purposes for which the wildlife refuge was established. But in reality, the livestock refuge managers are under tremendous political pressure to open up the refuges to livestock grazing, and so they will bend the law and make excuses for why livestock grazing is good for wildlife, even though there is no instance where adding cattle or adding sheep is actually beneficial to any species that's native to these ecosystems.
Is there any way to mitigate the methane emissions?
In, you know, feedlot operations, there have been suggestions that feeding the cattle a diet that includes a red seaweed can reduce the amount of methane emissions that they have. That's really not an option for the livestock that are out grazing in arid public land. Those cattle and sheep actually have a bigger methane output than cattle on feedlots, even if they're fed just the usual diet of grains, because those animals that are out on public lands are eating the poorest quality forage that's out there for a cow to eat or a sheep to eat. And with the poor quality forage, that means more metabolic waste products like methane.
You advocate environmentally protective grazing regulations. What are those regulations that you advocate?
One of the regulations that we would like to see is we would like to see livestock grazing limited to a maximum of 30% utilization of forage. In other words, leaving more than two-thirds of the grass and other edible plants behind for the native species and for the survival and reconstitution of the ecosystem. Also, in terms of sage grouse, we're big advocates of leaving behind at least 7 inches of grass height so that the sage grouse have the adequate hiding cover that they need to escape detection from their native predators as they waddle around on the ground where they spend most of their time.
Well, bison also are out grazing on wild lands. How do you feel about bison grazing? Do they emit the same amount of methane that cattle do?
You know, the bison are also methane producers, but in terms of their ecosystem impacts, they are far more compatible than cattle. Bison evolved in North America together with these arid ecosystems, and they graze all over the landscape. They will wander far from water. They will use steep slopes, where cattle came from the boggy forests of northern Europe, where they kind of had a spoiled existence. So when you put them out in the arid West, they gravitate to those lush riparian streamside habitats that have the greenest grass and the greatest productivity. Unfortunately, those same streamside habitats also are most important for wildlife, for their habitat needs. So when you concentrate cattle grazing along the rivers and along the streams, you're not only causing problems for the streams themselves, but you're also destroying the native ecosystems upon which all the native wildlife species rely.
What about cattle bison that are bred, or cattle are bred with bison? Is there some reduction in the amount of methane that cattle produce?
I have never heard of such a thing, and frankly, bison and cattle should never be bred together. Bison are a precious, rare wildlife species, and we can't afford to lose any bison offspring by crossbreeding them with cattle and creating herds of beefalo or cattle or any other Franken animal that you know then subtracts from the ability to take bison and move them out into the wild and reestablish wildlife populations.
But they're already some ranchers already have cattle or beefalo or bison, whatever you call them, out on their ranches. They've already been interbred. And I don't know if they're sterile or if they breed among themselves.
They're not sterile. They can continue to breed and have offspring that can continue the trait. And what that has led to is a loss of genetically pure wild bison herds because so many of the bison herds have come into contact with these bison that are introgressed with cattle gene. So it's a really big problem. It's great when ranchers want to run bison that are pure bison. Even if they're going to run them as livestock, it's much better for the land than running cattle as livestock. But we shouldn't be bastardizing the bison herds by crossbreeding cattle and bison.
There are purebred, the bison in Yellowstone are purebred, as I understand it. What about the bison that are in South Dakota, in Wind Cave and those parks there?
You know, even the bison in Yellowstone National Park have now been shown to have a very small fraction of cattle genes.
Really? Oh, my.
So, you know, it's pretty tough to find a genetically pure bison herd. But, you know, those herds in the places like the National Bison Range in Montana, in Yellowstone National Park, on other national parks, they are the ones that are in the best shape in terms of their genetic purity.
Mm-hmm. So, do you advocate for bison being allowed to roam on national forest land and in wildlife refuges or anywhere else?
We absolutely think that bison ought to be treated as native wildlife and ought to be allowed freedom to roam and the ability to repopulate all of their native habitats. We understand the political difficulties on private lands, but there's really no excuse at all not to have bison on all of those public lands, whether they're national forests, Bureau of Land Management lands, national wildlife refuges, as a replacement for cattle.
Have you ever had a legislator who is willing to advocate legislation to do that?
Well, you know, we do have right now Senator Cory Booker, who has introduced the Tribal Heritage and American Bison, Wolf, and Grizzly Bear Restoration Act. And that legislation would basically treat all three of these rare wildlife species like we treat bald and golden eagles today. In other words, you're not allowed to kill them. You're not allowed to possess their parts unless you're a tribal member. And that really would do a lot, I think, to help us restore the bison. In terms of actively replacing livestock with bison, interestingly, there's a fellow by the name of Mike Phillips, who was a senator in the Montana legislature for a while, and he works for the Turner Endangered Species Fund and is associated with the Turner Ranches. And they, on their private lands and also partly on national forest lands, have replaced cattle with bison. So there's a big model that has been tried successfully by the Turner Corporation, and it has been, I think, a way that other ranchers can learn from how to ranch more sustainably in a way that's healthier for native ecosystems on private land.
Well, I know that there are bison on some tribal lands, notably up in Montana, but do tribes run cattle on their lands, and are they being replaced with bison?
I think in some places some of the tribes are replacing their cattle herds with bison. When you see tribes like the Shoshone and Arapaho on the Wind River Reservation and the Blackfeet and the you know other places where they're re-establishing tribal bison herds, those bison herds are using lands that more often than not were grazed by cattle before on the reservation by the tribal members. And so they're getting back to their original cultural traditions, and they're bringing the land back to its original native herbivore, and it's a win-win for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, the tribes are running their bison herds as livestock, and that's an improvement over cattle.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, they're running their bison herds as wildlife and as wild bison herds, and that's even better.
So let's move on to talk about wild horses. There are wild horses on public lands. Do you support that, or do you find that a problem?
You know, Western Watersheds Project takes a very nuanced and in some ways a somewhat a neutral position on wild horses. We recognize that wild horses were evolved on this continent in North America until about 5,900 years ago, when we have the last recorded fossil evidence of wild horses prior to the arrival of European explorers.
Right.
Also, we recognize that some indigenous people, have oral traditions and other evidence that there may have been wild horses here the entire time. But the archaeological and paleontological consensus is that they were extirpated in North America for that period, about 5,000 years, until Columbus arrived, and soon thereafter we had the Spanish conquistadors bringing horses onto the North American continent. And then we do think that wild horses can have an impact on native ecosystems if they're overpopulated, just like you can have ecosystem impact from overpopulated cattle or native herbivores like elk that will get overpopulated. So that is a complexity to keep our eyes on. But one of the overarching things that we pay attention to is that wild horses often are being scapegoated for environmental degradation that's actually being caused by domestic cattle and sheep. And the Bureau of Land Management actively engages in this kind of disinformation. So one of the roles that Western Watersheds Project plays is to tell the truth about the comparative levels of impact. Now, wild horses are present on only 11% of Western public lands, whereas cattle and sheep are present on the vast majority.
Right.
So there are lots of areas where there's no impact at all because there aren't wild horses. But even on those areas where you have wild horses present because they've been designated as wild horse herd management areas, the Bureau of Land Management in almost all cases is leasing those same lands out to cattle and sheep ranchers to graze those lands down. And those cattle and sheep ranchers are being allocated again half and more than half of the annual forage production. And so when you sit there and say wild horses are causing overgrazing on the range and half or more than half of the grazing is caused by cattle as an agency, you're lying. And we're here to bust those lies.
Are those wild horses all on BLM land, or are they on in national forests and also on state lands or even tribal lands?
There are designated wild horses on Bureau of Land Management lands primarily, although there are a small handful of fairly tiny wild horse territories, they're called, on Forest Service land in a few places like Oregon and Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And then on tribal lands, they have their own free-roaming equids. They're not protected under the Wild Horse and Burro Act because they're on the tribe's own sovereign lands.
No.
But, they face some of the same dynamics. And on the other hand, they don't have an agency that is dedicated to the same kind of helicopter roundups and removals and long-term storage that the federal agencies have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, our guest today has been Eric Mulvar. He's Executive Director of the Western Watersheds Project. And this has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. Thanks. If you like more information or to hear some of our previous interviews, look up kgvm.org and check it out. Scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife, and you'll find some other interesting interviews. Thanks for listening. I'm Jay Schell. Bye-bye.